You're listening to the North Carolina Reading Service, broadcasting from Raleigh, North Carolina, serving the blind and print-impaired community since 1983. This is Nancy Jones. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from the September 2020 issue of Vanity Fair magazine. This is Vanity Fair Part B. Blue Bloods by Evel Ewing, with opening illustration by Sean Martinborough, with coloring by Christopher Sotomayor. The opening illustration shows a Fraternal Order of Police badge with tree roots intertwined. Police unions are more a fraternal brotherhood than labor group, which puts them squarely at odds with solidarity. The man stands before them, head slightly bowed. He is gangly, awkward, against the backdrop of the officers' firm march. They are hurried, and he is not. Everything about them is fast, crisp, matte. We watch the push. We watch him fall. We watch them pass his body. Swirling around him, an eddy of thick black fabric. When the blood comes, it drifts languidly across the concrete. When night falls, this is the story they tell. During that skirmish involving protesters, one person was injured when he tripped and fell. But when the video appears, the world will see the police shove Martin Gugino to the ground, fracturing his skull. The email from John Evans, president of the Buffalo Police Benevolent Association, came the next day. Evans forcefully defended the police officers implicated in the assault. After witnessing firsthand how these two officers were treated, Evans wrote, "I can tell you they tried to F over these guys like I have never seen in my 54 years. He signed off the email by writing, "Fraternally, John Evans, PBA." There are people who will tell you that people like John Evans lead a union. But this is not a union. This is something else. This is a brotherhood. It abides no law but its own. It scorns the personhood of all but its own brethren. It derides all creatures outside its own clan. And for that reason, the brotherhood is not only a hurdle impeding reform, it is the architecture of an alternate reality, one that seethes and bubbles just beneath the surface of our own, and it's a reality in which none of us are human. In May, the Chicago chapter of the Fraternal Order of Police elected John Catanzara as president. According to a 2017 report by the United States Department of Justice, the police department in Chicago engages in a pattern or practice of using force that is in violation of the Constitution, where officers' force practices unnecessarily endanger themselves, a pattern which results from systemic deficiencies in training and accountability. And yet, even given the city's abysmal standard of police conduct, in his 25 years on the force, Catanzara has managed to distinguish himself from his peers by being especially awful. According to the Citizens Police Data Project, a database of police misconduct records made public after a lawsuit and Freedom of Information Act request, Catanzara has been the subject of 50 complaints, putting him in the 96th percentile for allegations. At the time he was elected to lead the FOP, Catanzara was assigned to administrative duty. According to the Chicago Sun-Times, he is the first president to take on the role while stripped of his official police powers. In June, when asked about the killing of George Floyd, Catanzara referred to Officer Derek Chauvin's actions as an improper police tactic. "Explain to me how race had anything to do with it," he went on. "There's no proof or evidence that race had anything to do with it. Katanzara has said that any lodge members showing support for protesters could face disciplinary action from the FOP and perhaps expulsion. Chicago's Fraternal Order of Police is a local chapter of the larger national organization of the same name. The national FOP boasts more than 2,100 such lodges, representing more than 330,000 members, which makes it, according to its website, the world's largest organization of sworn law enforcement officers. When Chicago police officer Robert Rialmo killed Quintonio Legrier and Betty Jones, a young man having a mental health episode, and his neighbor, who answered the door, Rialmo was fired. The vice president of the Chicago FOP called the Civilian Office of Police Accountability, which recommended the firing, a political witch hunt on police officers. The investigations are unfair and politically motivated. When Jason Van Dyke was convicted of second-degree murder for the death of Laquan McDonald, the FOP defended him. When four of the officers accused of aiding in the cover-up were fired, a different FOP vice president used the decision as an occasion to impress upon police board members that they should not fall to the pressure of the media or the radical police haters. These men were sworn officers of the law, but they did not look at Van Dyke as a convicted murderer who had broken that law. They did not look at him and see police, a social category, a profession, a uniform one puts on and can take off. They looked at him and saw their brother. They saw a different type of being, bound by an oath that transcends civilian understanding, and by virtue of Van Dyke's being in their eyes, he could do no wrong. The same logic underlies the phrase Blue Lives Matter, which semantically equates the color of a uniform with the non-negotiable, unshakable fact of blackness. It's a phenomenon not unlike the transfiguration that took place behind the eyes of Darren Wilson. "It looks like a demon," he told the grand jury in describing Michael Brown. Michael Brown, not man, but beast. Jason Van Dyke, not man, but kin. A brother in the pantheon. A demigod among demigods. His actions deemed necessary and virtuous because they were wrought by his hand, and his hand was necessary and virtuous. Of course, as Catanzara's comment about support for protesters demonstrates, it's not that it's impossible to be cast out from the Brotherhood. The unforgivable sin within the Brotherhood is to cast aspersions against the only people whom the Brotherhood recognizes as human, its own kind. Shoot a boy in the back, and you can still be in the Brotherhood. Side with the people who are asking questions, or raise a fist with them, or kneel before them, or talk to them, and you are out. Maya Angelou had a thing she used to say. When people show you who they are, believe them the first time. Perhaps it's time for America to heed Angelou's advice. The Fraternal Order of Police has told us candidly what they are, that they are not a union, but a fraternity, a brotherhood. We ought to believe them. History would suggest that unionism and policing are, at their foundation, incompatible. For one thing, the officers who founded the FOP made it very clear that it was not a union. In the volume, The Fraternal Order of Police, 1915 to 1976, A History, a work commissioned by the FOP itself, co-founder Martin L. Toole is quoted as saying, "We are banded together for our own enjoyment." Founding officers rejected the name United Association of Police because that name sounded too much like union, and union sounded too antagonistic. These officers sought a way to bargain collectively over issues like wages and hours without affiliating themselves with labor organizations. And as labor historian Rosemary Fuhrer told me in an interview, until the 1970s, there was a feeling that police didn't belong in the union movement. And now I think we have to realize that that is part of our history. From the stark reality that people were confronted with police brutality whenever they tried to assert their rights as union members. Indeed, the most formative days of the labor movement were marked by police violence against workers. During the 1886 Haymarket affair, police fired on the crowd during a dispute with striking workers. During the 1921 Battle of Blair Mountain, the largest labor uprising in American history, thousands of West Virginians led by the United Mine Workers were in armed struggle against thousands of police and National Guardsmen. The local sheriff, Don Chafin, was paid by mine operators to beat, arrest, or intimidate suspected union organizers, a job which each year earned him more than 10 times his annual salary in bribes and helped him maintain a well-funded department. By 1921, his net worth was about $350,000. In the 1937 Memorial Day massacre, police fired on a demonstration of steel workers, killing 10 and seriously wounding many others, including a baby and an 11-year-old boy. A worker on the scene said that as the injured fell under the hail of bullets, it looked as though they were being mowed down with a scythe. And the institution of policing as a means of violently controlling working persons' right to economic freedom has deeper roots than even the labor movement itself. The need to attack workers in the name of private interest is historically intertwined, like a double helix, with the need to control, limit, and sanction black autonomy. You will find that this question of the control of labor underlies every other question of state interest, South Carolinian William H. Trescott told the governor of South Carolina in 1865. The end of the Civil War meant that millions of black people were transformed from items of property from which labor could be forcibly and freely extracted to independent humans with at least nominally the agency to do with their labor what they pleased for their own benefit. Virtually from the moment the Civil War ended, writes historian Eric Foner, the search began for legal means of subordinating a volatile black population that regarded economic independence as a corollary of freedom and the old labor discipline as a badge of slavery. In the absence of slavery as the means by which black people could be made to stay in one place and work when and how white people needed them to work, the plantation class looked to the law to ensure that they would. Hence, the Reconstruction-era legislation known as the Black Codes was born. In Mississippi, being black and not having written proof that you were employed was now illegal. In South Carolina, being black and having a job other than servant or farmer was illegal unless you paid an annual tax of up to $100. Being in a traveling circus or an acting troupe, illegal. In Virginia, asking for pay beyond the usual and common wages given to other laborers was illegal. In Florida, disrespecting or disobeying your employer was illegal. In some areas, fishing and hunting, or even owning guns, were now banned, as these activities could lessen black dependence on white people for employment. And who would enforce these new laws? The police. In some cases, Foner writes, these newly deputized men wore their old Confederate uniforms as they patrolled black homesteads, seizing weapons and arresting people for labor violations. Despite this history, those who lead America's police unions raise a cautionary alarm that teachers and other public sector workers should be wary of any attempts to curtail police power, lest they find themselves at the center of the next effort to limit union rights. In June, Patrick J. Lynch, who heads the Police Benevolent Association of the City of New York, wrote an op-ed in the New York Daily News, drawing a direct connection between efforts to defund the police and a broader labor struggle. Our brothers and sisters in the labor movement should be very careful. If they support a successful campaign to strip police officers of our union rights, they will see those same tactics repeated against teachers, bus drivers, nurses, and other public sector workers across this country. But there's a crucial difference. How many unions are there where you're assigned a gun and told you can shoot people? Philadelphia District Attorney Larry Krasner asked me during a phone interview. I mean, they have superpowers. They are given superpowers over the lives and freedom of other people, over the integrity of their bodies. Krasner told me of two instances in his legal career when he defended women who, after finding their police officer husbands cheating and trying to divorce them, had been arrested by those same husbands. One was arrested twice. The other was arrested alongside her brother, who had tried to defend her. Both women were found not guilty, despite police officers testifying against them on the stand. Krasner attempted to sue on their behalf for monetary damages, but also injunctive relief, for the police department to change its policies to require an arrest of a relative or spouse to be overseen by a supervisor. The answer that I got from the city is, nope, we're not going to do any of that. Dealing with the police department, contract negotiations, we're not even going to get into it, so we'll just pay you more money, Krasner recalls. So, you know, that kind of told me everything I needed to know. It was an overwhelming imbalance of power. It's a city, I think, that in many ways is so politically compromised by its relationship with police unions that they have for a very long time pretty much given them anything they wanted. Krasner believes that the situation is exacerbated by the fact that in Philadelphia, the FOP allows retired officers to be voting members. The police union is the voice of the past, says Krasner. And in Philly, the past is Frank Rizzo, the 1970s-era Philadelphia mayor who openly told his supporters to vote white. Before becoming mayor, Rizzo was police commissioner. During his campaign, Rizzo promised his supporters that after he was elected, he would make Attila the Hun look like a faggot. Rachel Rollins, district attorney of Suffolk County, which includes Boston, as well as nearby Chelsea, Revere, and Winthrop, agrees with Krasner, telling me that police are the only section of our municipal, local, state, or federal government that has the lethal and legal authority to kill you with no oversight. For this reason, she dismisses Lynch's comparison between police unions and teachers' unions. If a teacher strangled George Floyd as an 11-year-old, Rollins said, no DA would even wait a nanosecond to charge that teacher with a homicide. We would be shocked and appalled. But when police do it, we have been so triggered to believe law enforcement, right, to not question them. When you have the authority to do something as final as death without oversight, you are different than any other union we are talking about. Beyond this point, police carry guns and are permitted by the state to kill people is a deeper distinction. The task of policing itself is intrinsically counter to the ideology of a union. A union is supposed to protect the rights, and the labor movement is supposed to protect the rights of all working people, said Sherry Davis Faulkner, a program director at the Center for Innovation in Worker Organization in the School of Management and Labor Relations at Rutgers University. The point is to be lifting up all working people. That is the work. Collective bargaining and having bargaining units, that is a part of it. But it's also pushing an ideology that people should not be exploited. Police unions do not and cannot promote this ideology because doing so would require them to confront the infrastructure that has been built for them to be policing black bodies and protecting white communities, Davis Faulkner told me. In its best formulation, the labor movement has been about the concept of solidarity, says Fuhrer, who studies political conflict and the labor history of the late 19th and 20th centuries at Northern Illinois University. And so that is the key conundrum here, is that if you're an entity that's sworn against solidarity, you can put your foot on the neck of a working-class person. It is the cardinal issue that we're facing right now. What do you do with a group of workers that are in your movement whose purpose is a state purpose, whose purpose is to deny protest rights and to deny solidarity? In Minneapolis, after the killing of George Floyd and subsequent protest, Bob Kroll, president of the Police Officers Federation of Minneapolis, wrote a letter to membership in which he said, "I commend you for the excellent police work you are doing in keeping your co-workers and others safe during what everyone except us refuses to call a riot. What has been very evident throughout this process is you have lacked support from the top. This terrorist movement that is currently occurring was a long-time build-up which dates back years." In August 2019, when Daniel Pantaleo, the NYPD officer who killed Eric Garner, lost his job, Lynch, the PBA president, condemned the decision. "The police commissioner needs to know he's lost his police department," he said at a press conference. Lynch declared that if Pantaleo could be labeled reckless, the condemnation could be applied to any police officer, and warned that the commissioner would wake up tomorrow to discover that the cop haters are still not satisfied, but it will be too late. After Tamir Rice was killed, Jeffrey Falmer, the president of the Cleveland Police Patrolmen's Association, told MSNBC that this shooting was justified. "It was tragic that it was a 12-year-old, but it was justified." Indeed, for American policing to function, physical assault is an important tool, but as important is intimidation. The threat of physical assault and the psychological terror it engenders. And for those tools to work, they require the premise of impunity. Elevating the police officer as a different kind of being, one unencumbered by the laws of civic comportment or even the basic laws of reality. It requires not only that Alabama state troopers beat John Lewis after he marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge in 1965, fracturing his skull. It requires a system that defines Lewis as the criminal in that scenario and the trooper as the guardian of safety and order. It requires not only that a Chicago police officer guarding a statue of Christopher Columbus this past July be able to punch 18-year-old Miracle Boyd in the mouth, knocking out her front teeth. It requires us to see the video and know that the officer will go unnamed and unpunished. It requires not only that a New York City police officer crack 20-year-old Dona Zayer's head against the pavement, causing her to have a seizure. It requires a commanding officer to watch and do nothing. It requires Lynch to refer to the officer who shoved Zayer as someone whose boss sent him out there to do a job, who was put in a bad situation during a chaotic time, and to refer to the decision to charge him with assault as dereliction of duty. For the police to act as they do, and for the body politic to accept it, requires not only fear or force, but a reconfiguration of the very fabric of reality as we know it. Part of what fascist politics does, explains philosopher Jason Stanley, is get people to dissociate from reality. In The Origins of Totalitarianism, Hannah Arendt argues that such politics craft an alternate universe, an unreality. It is not so much the barbed wire, says Arendt, as the skillfully manufactured unreality of those whom it fences in that provokes such enormous cruelties and ultimately makes extermination look like a perfectly normal measure. When I was in college, I was a resident assistant, which meant that in some instances I was the first responder when someone had been sexually assaulted. I once confronted a young man who was the president of one of the fraternities, where a resident of mine had recently, she thought, she wasn't sure, she had woken up in the attic, she told me, alone. She didn't know where he had gone, or... I ask, how could you choose to call someone your brother when you know they are capable of something like that? He looked away. This was the wrong question. The whole point of the brotherhood is that it enables a willful not knowing. The brotherhood swallows all other planes of reality that could pose an existential challenge. I had asked the wrong question, because the answer to how can you call someone your brother when he does something like that is because he is my brother. The brotherhood is a self-contained universe with its own physics, its own gravity. Within a band of brothers, there is no law that supersedes the law of the brotherhood itself. To be part of a brotherhood is not to be a member of something, for membership is fleeting and outside oneself. To be part of a brotherhood is not simply to be a workaday person who belongs to a collective core, but to be reborn as a new type of thing, nestled in a selfhood, intimately woven among other selfhoods, moving as one through a world in which you trust nothing but one another, because yourself has become inextricable from all those other selves you call brother. In the brotherhood, there is no such thing as wrongful police action. A member of the brotherhood cannot err any more than a dropped apple can fall toward the sky. The man who choked Eric Garner to death can never be reckless. All police work is excellent police work. The death of a 12-year-old boy is justified. You watch the video again. He tripped and fell. He tripped and fell. In the days after my city rose against the clouds, I woke to a news item that made me laugh out loud. When desperate and angry and tired people were breaking windows across the South Side, a group of police officers had broken into the campaign offices of Representative Bobby Rush. The surveillance footage is almost cartoonish. The officers ate popcorn, they made coffee. As Chicago burned, they napped on the couch. When the incident became public, Catanzara told the press that Rush or his staff had asked the officers to come. He told local news that Rush was an absolute liar, a piece of garbage, and that anyway, the coffee and popcorn were bought with taxpayer money, and the officers were taxpayers, were they not? Of Mayor Lori Lightfoot's criticism of the officers, Catanzara said, "Shame on her. forever questioning their valor and their heroism and the officers of CPD to make it sound like they were letting other officers get the crap beat out of them while they sat there and slept. That is a disgusting accusation. She owes the men and women an apology for even implying that was. I read the statement. I looked again at the picture of the sleeping officer. He tripped and fell. He tripped and fell. A union is a pact, wrought among the human, among the fallible, and there can be no error in the brotherhood. And the brotherhood can never be reformed, because reform requires fidelity to something external, and the brotherhood has fidelity only for itself. This is the unreality of the brotherhood, and as long as police are endowed with near-absolute state-sanctioned power, it is our unreality. We live behind its gates. Abolition's Promise by Josie Duffy Rice, with opening illustration by Sean Martinborough, with coloring by Christopher Sotomayor, and the opening illustration shows an eagle crashing through glass. What we talk about when we talk about addressing the savage roots of policing, justice, and safety for everyone. Long before the internet caught wind of him, Henry Earle was already a local legend. By the time the Charleston Gazette dubbed him a cult status hero, and Newsweek called him the town drunk, Earle was already known around Lexington, Kentucky, as James Brown. He liked to dance, and he'd do a few moves in exchange for a couple bucks, money which he'd usually promptly spend on alcohol. Earle was born in the Jim Crow South and adopted at age 7. Drinking was a habit he picked up as a teenager after his mother died, one he never could quite shake. By age 19, he was homeless, and by 20, he'd been arrested for the first time. That was back in 1970. Over the next several decades, Earle was arrested more than 1,500 times, almost always for alcohol intoxication. That is how he became known as the world's most arrested man. Over the years, he spent a total of more than 16 years in jail, usually in couple-day spurts. He was never once charged with violence or theft. "I like to drink," he said once. "Alcoholic, that's what I am. Every police knows me on the force. They see me drunk, they pick me up, I get 5 days." For almost 50 years, this was Earl's life. No home, no family, just alcohol and jail. He was a regular at the local bar scene, known for sometimes overstaying his welcome. The locals would see him at house parties sometimes. He'd go for the free beer. He tried court-mandated rehab a few times, but it didn't stick. "It's a weekly, if not every 2 or 3 days thing," said a police spokesperson in 2013. "He's never doing bad or illegal things purposely. He's just so highly intoxicated that he's posing a danger to himself." Interest in Earle peaked a few years back, with websites dedicated to his mugshots that amusedly tracked his arrest. Late-night TV cracked jokes at his expense. National outlets ran stories on him. Around town, people called him harmless and happy, a lovable loser. But there were times Earle saw it differently. "It's a sad life. It ain't worth a dog," he said in 2003, tearing up. "I got more sense than some people think I do. I've seen what it's doing. It is ruining my life." Over the past 10 years, the American public has been subjected to countless videos of civilians being killed, beaten, or tortured by law enforcement. Each new story is more documentation in the growing mountain of evidence, detailing how the state casually inflicts violence against its citizens. Henry Earle is not in any of those videos. He hasn't been tortured on the street. He hasn't been shot in the back. He has not been injected with a lethal dose of ketamine. But year after year, he has been the victim of state violence, subject to arrest and the dangers of jail. But what Henry Earle shares with Walter Scott, George Floyd, and Elijah McClain is the problem of American policing. The consistent application of violent solutions to nonviolent and often non-existent problems. The solution has been tried over 1,000 times on Henry Earle to no effect. Perhaps it's time for something new. Last year, Attorney General William Barr addressed the Fraternal Order of Police's biennial conference. What stands between chaos and carnage on the one hand, and the civilized and tranquil society we all yearn for, Barr told his audience, is the thin blue line of law enforcement. Barr is a right-wing Republican who has for years advocated for a harsher and more robust police state. But his proclamation reflected a deeply held idea in American politics that police are essential to an ordered and just country. Barr's worldview is time-honored and bipartisan. Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden might not be the same politician he was when he championed the 1994 crime bill, but his belief in the necessity of American policing, Biden proposes to pump $300 million in federal dollars to the police, has not changed. And it's not just politicians who proselytize the necessity of policing. Boilerplate TV procedurals, true crime podcast, and the evening news sell us a world where the police, beleaguered and badgered, are ultimately all that stands between those of us who wish to live in society and the others who would choose savagery. This is a myth. Despite much reporting of a spike in murder this year, the long-term trend still shows the murder rate hovering roughly in the same place it was in the 1960s, half of what it was in 1980. And while procedurals may paint a picture of cops chasing serial killers weekly, the actual face of police is more mundane. In June, the New York Times called available data and estimated that police spend roughly 4% of their time addressing violent crime. Most of their time is spent dealing with non-criminal matters. And yet, no matter the call, the loud party next door, the permit for a parade, the expired car tags, the escort for a funeral procession, the elderly welfare check, the frolickers barbecuing in the park, the schoolyard fight, the opioid overdose, the homeless person outside in the cold, the stray dog, the state's answer is to respond with armed agents blessed with the near unimpeachable right to kill. The impact is not theoretical. After James Smith noticed the door of his neighbor's home was open and the lights were on, Smith called the police, hoping an officer would conduct a wellness check on his neighbor. Instead, Officer Aaron Dean shot and killed Tatiana Jefferson in her own home as she played video games with her young nephew. Smith was left to draw a grim conclusion. "We don't have a relationship with the police because we don't trust the police," Smith recently told the BBC. Even the impact of policing on violent crime is debatable. We are fighting an unrelenting, never-ending fight against criminal predators in our society, Barr claimed at the FOP conference in New Orleans. But the never-ending fight in the very city in which Barr was speaking is not going well. New Orleans has the fourth highest murder rate in the nation, but clears only 35% of homicide cases. In 2018, the city's police cleared only 2% of all rapes. The country at large isn't much better. Last year, the Washington Post launched an investigation into murder clearance rates in 50 cities over the course of 10 years. The results were bracing. Despite a nationwide drop in violence to historic lows, the Post reported, 34 of the 50 cities have a lower homicide arrest rate than a decade ago. In St. Louis, during the period the Post studied, it calculated that 54% of all homicides resulted in no arrest. In Baltimore, during the period it studied, the Post calculated that only 35% of all homicides resulted in an arrest. In Chicago, the rate was 26%. The line isn't just thin and blue, it's porous and arbitrary. One argument for policing holds that while police may not solve much violent crime, their very presence helps ensure safety. In a survey of research, the National Institute of Justice concludes that hotspot policing was associated with reductions in violent crime relative to control areas. What is hotspot policing? According to the survey, it includes order maintenance and drug enforcement crackdowns, increased gun searches and seizures, and zero-tolerance policing. This isn't just a list of policing tactics. It's a list of prerequisites for the present moment. For order maintenance, Eric Garner was suffocated on a New York sidewalk. For drug enforcement crackdowns, Breonna Taylor was killed in her own home. For gun search and seizure, the black neighborhoods of New York endured stop and frisk. For zero-tolerance policing, George Floyd was choked on a Minneapolis street. It would be at least honest if we said that enduring arbitrary harassing, beating, tasing, and strangulation by the state was the price of being associated with reduction in violent crime relative to control areas. That we don't say this, and that we only imply it for certain classes of people, exposes the assumptions built into American policing. It's those assumptions that, on the one hand, allow Henry Earle to be arrested more than 1,000 times, and on the other, offer a sporting chance for anyone who'd like to try their hand at murder or rape. Policing accomplishes this dubious feat by imposing cost on innocent people who happen to live in proximity to crime, and others who simply happen to resemble in skin color those we think of as criminal. This is a system begging for reform, and the best way to reform an institution as compromised as American policing is by abolishing it. It is impossible to imagine American policing without the institution foundational to America itself, enslavement. Indeed, from colonial times up through the Civil War, the largest police force in the country wasn't primarily found in the early towns or the bustling metropolises, but in the slave societies of the South, where to be a white man was to be deputized. Enslavement, where the enslaver is both the maker and enforcer of law, was the first experience of policing for black people. But through the invention of slave patrols, militias charged with enforcing the law against the enslaved, the policing powers were expanded. All white persons were permitted and in some regards required to exercise a police power over slaves, the white supremacist historian U.B. Phillips noted. In many states, white people were not only allowed, but required to whip, capture, and jail enslaved people they encountered. They had a mandate to prevent all caballings amongst Negroes by dispersing of them when drumming or playing, meaning they could punish any enslaved people for simply interacting with each other. The patrollers operated, as one of their number put it, without warrant and at my own discretion. The shadows of American policing are here. In the prisons, we find the absolute mastery once enjoyed by the planter class. In the wide discrepancy granted the slave patrol, one sees the echoes of broken windows policing. And the bodies of Trayvon Martin and Ahmaud Arbery reflect the extension of police powers far beyond official police. Slave patrols were born of the propertied interest of white people seeking to maximally exploit black labor, an endeavor that did not fade with emancipation. In many ways, it was reinforced. Planters may no longer have owned their labor force, But that didn't stop them from seeking out means of preventing the formerly enslaved from freely selling their labor. Policing was key to this effort, which saw control lost through slavery regained through a panoply of laws that threatened arrest for everything from not having an annual work contract to malicious mischief, and criminalized persons who led idle or disorderly lives. Depending on the state, the arresting officers could consist of urban police, militias drawn from former Confederate soldiers, or merely any white man. While there was a brief reprieve during Reconstruction, after federal troops departed the South in 1877, white Southerners employed policing to ensure a permanent and pliable source of labor. When blacks tried to go north for jobs during the Great Migration, the South resorted to coercion and interception worthy of the Soviet Union, writes Isabel Wilkerson in The Warmth of Other Suns. In Brookhaven, Mississippi, authorities stopped a train with 50 colored migrants on it and sidetracked it for 3 days. In Albany, Georgia, the police tore up tickets of colored passengers as they stood, waiting to board, dashing their hopes of escape. A minister in South Carolina, having seen his parishioners off, was arrested at the station on the charge of helping colored people get out. It is tempting to think the Northern police departments unsullied by white supremacy. The assumption would be wrong. Throughout the entirety of Jim Crow, Northern police often parroted their Southern counterparts. From the moment the immigrants set foot in the North and West, writes Wilkerson, they were blamed for the troubles of the cities they fled to. Indeed, police departments took the cue and regarded blacks much as the broader society had, as outcasts and threats. In 1917, in East St. Louis, Illinois, white workers, angered by blacks brought in to replace them during a strike, rioted and fired shots into colored homes, writes Wilkerson. The police, charged with quelling the riot, in some cases joined in, as did some of the state militia. In 1943, during the Detroit race riot, police openly sympathized with the white rioters, writes historian Thomas J. Chagrue. 17 blacks were shot to death by the police. No whites were. 10 years later, as black families tried to integrate Chicago's Trumbull Park homes, they were granted minimal protection from the police, who sympathized with the whites who terrorized the families. Still, the greatest indicator of the role law enforcement in the North played in suppressing their black populations lay in the prison population. Even in an era of relatively low incarceration, the rate in the northern cities stood at 7 to 1, exactly the same as today. That the police were not concerned with neutrality nor law enforcement was always clear to black people. In 1967, after a series of riots, President Lyndon Johnson convened the Kerner Commission to report on the riots' origins and recommend a series of reforms. Read today, the report is bracing for a haunting quality, its timelessness. Just like the countless commissions that have followed it, the Kerner Commission found a police department with too many responsibilities. Filling in for the defunding and decline of societal institutions. Just as today, the Kerner Commission found black communities complaining of stop-and-frisk tactics. And then, as now, voices of authority blamed police violence on the inherent pathologies of the black population, instead of the learned brutality of the police. Among the commission's recommendations, an intolerance for police brutality, a clear and enforced policy of law enforcement in ghetto areas as is the same as in other communities, and eliminating a focus on smaller crimes, such as gambling or loitering, in favor of crimes that threaten life and property. After the report was published, it became a bestseller, but Johnson quickly scuttled it, and the era of law and order commenced. This article will be continued in the next installment. This program is intended for a blind and print-impaired audience. I'm Nancy Jones, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service and broadcasting from its studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. Vanity Fair Part A airs via special subchannel receiver on Saturday and Sunday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Vanity Fair Part B airs via special subchannel receiver on Monday and Tuesday nights at 11 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, streaming via the World Wide Web at those times. Both Parts A and B are available as a podcast at our website, www.ncreadingservice.org. Opening and closing music by Calexico, interval selection by Mark Hoffman.